This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Sounds Choral, a program that seeks to present the vast body of choral repertoire in a way that is intelligible, relevant, entertaining, and uplifting. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, the artistic director of Amor Artis, the Monmouth Civic Chorus, and Princeton Pro Musica. Over the years, together, we have celebrated particular composers, we've explored some particular themes, compared settings of a well-known text, and more. But almost every single piece I've ever played on this program has had a text. Don't get me wrong, I love words, and I love the particular way that, in the best choral pieces, the marriage of music and word makes each of those elements more impactful. And trust me, I spend a lot of rehearsal time trying to shape text. But regardless of which words are being sung, I'm even more fascinated by the seemingly infinite variety of colors and sounds the human voice is capable of making. Consider that an operatic dramatic soprano, Ella Fitzgerald, Dolly Parton, Ethel Merman, and the sopranos of a group like Voces 8 are, in fact, using the same instrument. They're essentially the same. Any one of us, when we sing, can play across various spectra. Bright, dark, twangy, lofty, forward, back. All of these will affect the sound. And there are two sets of cartilages in our larynx that we can use for singing that allow us to do things like belt on the one hand or sing really high in a falsetto on the other. Unlike, let's say, that of the oboe or the trumpet, the tube that makes the human voice is made of flesh, not wood or brass. It's flexible, and we can actually change the length and the shape of that tube to make an endless variety of vowels. So in the same way that a clarinet and violin can play the same pitch, but sound entirely distinct, we, with our voice, can sing the same pitch and on two different vowels that are also entirely distinct. And if you take away the dictates of the words themselves, then the vowel possibilities, not to mention the timbre and vocal production possibilities, are endless. Today's program features pieces in which composers play with these possibilities and use choral singing not as a conveyor of text, but as sound itself, as a color, as a texture. The first few pieces, written in the first quarter of the 20th century, are written by composers that some might call impressionist. These are composers that aimed in their music to evoke a strong impression or sensation, or wrote music that had some kind of program or narrative behind it. The first is by the composer most commonly associated with impressionism, Claude Debussy. The music critic Alex Ross has suggested that Debussy's rejection of the musical status quo was fueled by his jealous love of poetry and painting. Ross suggests, for him, music had fallen behind. It had nothing that rivaled free verse in poetry, the drift toward abstraction in painting, and the investigation of mystical spheres that was happening across the arts. Debussy eschewed traditional forms like the symphony in favor of music that felt improvisatory, in spite of meticulous craft, as though it were conjuring itself to life at each passing moment. In 1901, he premiered a set of three nocturnes. They had titles, Nuages, Clouds, Fêtes, Festivals, and Sirènes, Sirens. We're going to listen to the third of these, Sirens. About the set, Debussy said, "The title Nocturnes is intended to have here a more general and, more particularly, a more decorative meaning. It's not meant to designate the usual form of a nocturne, but rather all the impressions and the special effects of light that the word suggests. Sirène depicts the sea and its countless rhythms, and presently, amongst the waves, silvered by the moonlight, is heard the mysterious song of the sirens as they laugh and carry on." The score for this piece is remarkable. It's this funny combination of extreme complexity and extreme restraint. "The muse," Debussy said, "should always be discreet." And indeed, to my eye, there is not a single note of superfluous pith There's no unnecessary doubling or anything like that larding up the score. And yet, some bars of this piece have four or five different rhythmic patterns going at once. The harmony, too, shifts easily between chords, sort of via common chord tones, ebbing and flowing back and forth like waves. The coloristic effects that he can get out of his orchestration are heard immediately. As soon as the piece starts, we are amidst gurgling waters, sea spray, and of course, the song of the sirens. We'll hear the Berlin Philharmonic and the Rundfunkchor Berlin under Claudio Abbado.
Thank you.
We just heard the third of Claude Debussy's Nocturnes, Sirens, with the Berlin Philharmonic and Claudio Abbado. And if you're just joining us today, this is Sounds Choral. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, and we're listening to pieces that include chorus without words. We're going to turn next to Debussy's fellow Frenchman, Maurice Ravel. In 1910, Ravel was commissioned by Sergei Diaghilev, the director of the Russian ballet, the Ballet Russe, to write a piece on the Greek legend of Daphnis and Chloe. Now, though this piece didn't last long as a ballet, it did enter the orchestral repertoire right away in the form of two suites that Ravel created in 1913. It also is sometimes played as the full ballet score, and we're going to hear a piece of that this afternoon. Ravel described the music of Daphnis and Chloe as a choreographic symphony in three parts, a vast musical fresco. Less scrupulous as to archaism than faithful to the Greece of my dreams, which identifies quite willingly with that imagined and depicted by late 18th century French artists. So, to paint this vast musical fresco, Ravel indeed uses a giant canvas. The piece calls for the biggest orchestra he would ever use, plus chorus. And yet, though these forces are massive, the piece is at times completely light and transparent. There's this refined quality like chamber music everywhere. As a sometimes orchestrator myself, I stand in awe of this score. Ravel's abilities as an orchestrator are second to none. The beginning of the third section is a depiction in music of daybreak. Here, Ravel's craft, including his use of the chorus, is on full display. Sometimes orchestras perform this piece in an arrangement without the chorus, but to me, the presence of the chorus, not used constantly, but added at moments of transcendence, lends this human spectral quality to the sound. The voices are creating overtones that the instruments don't, and the musical whole truly glows and shimmers with all of the warmth of the human voice and the sunrise it's meant to depict. I challenge you to find more sumptuous sounds made only by humans and the instruments that they have built with their own hands. Here's the Daybreak section from Ravel's ballet Daphnis and Chloe with the Netherlands Chamber Choir, the Concertgebouw Orchestra, and Ricardo Chailly. We just heard the magnificent Daybreak section from Ravel's ballet Daphnis and Chloe, conducted by Ricardo Chailly with the Netherlands Chamber Choir and the Concertgebouw Orchestra. We'll turn now to a work by one of Ravel's most prominent students, the English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. Vaughan Williams' output is broad and richly varied, and even amidst that catalog, this next piece I'm going to play, Flos Campi, stands out as somewhat peculiar. It's a suite for solo viola, orchestra, and wordless chorus. The title, Flos Campi, refers not necessarily to flowers as you might find out in a field, but to the Rose of Sharon. And though the chorus doesn't have any words to sing, there are words on the score. Each of the six sections has at the head a verse from the Song of Solomon, and each movement takes its inspiration from that verse. It would seem that Vaughan Williams set out to make something not explicit, nobody says I am the Rose of Sharon, but evocative, and to his ear and at this time, something that sounded exotic. While the varied nature of the harmonic language and the instrumentation might owe something to Ravel, the sound world here is unmistakably Vaughan Williams' own. Starting, of course, with the sound of the viola, a favorite instrument of Vaughan Williams and one that turns up in so much of this early 20th century English repertoire. It's kind of funny, this paradoxical instrumentation or an irony that Vaughan Williams chose to use human voices in an instrumental way and to cast the role of the viola really as the singing voice. We will hear the viola lament and cry out. The first section is headed with the following quotation: as the lily among the thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. A bitonal duet for oboe and viola opens this first section and suggests this kind of love-sick quality. You'll hear a lot of tritones in the melody. One of my favorite composers, Herbert Howells, called this section a rhapsodic prelude. The second section takes inspiration from, for lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come. The simple melody of the second movement exploits the kind of slippery, easy-to-combine quality of the five notes of the pentatonic scale. Fragments and versions of a tune slide past each other in easy and endless rotations. Meanwhile, duple and triple rhythms elide the downbeats and swirl together. And here again, perhaps taking a cue from Ravel or Debussy, Vaughan Williams brilliantly deploys the sound of harp and celeste. The heading of the third movement returns us to a similar emotion to the first. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if ye find my beloved, tell him that I am sick of love. And here we get this lamenting cadenza from the viola. It continues in dialogue with the upper voices of the chorus in a way that is somewhat reminiscent of the sirène of Debussy that we heard earlier on this program. The last section, which is headed with just one sentence, set me as a seal upon thy heart. To bring off that simple and chipet, Vaughan Williams offers a straightforward melody in D major and embeds it in a vast kind of rainbow canvas, this pan diatonic wash of D major, moved along not by the momentum swings and the kind of lunges of traditional functional harmony, but instead just D major itself with endless scales planing up and down and across each other. Howells called this section the diatonic fulfillment of longing. Toward the end, there's a restatement of the opening oboe-viola duet, and the soloist has the last word, and the final chord is dissonant and unresolved, and this very enigmatic piece ends just as enigmatically as it began. Let's have a listen. Here, Matthew Best leads the chord and singers in the English Chamber Orchestra with a violist Nobuko Imai. We just heard a rather obscure but beautiful and fascinating piece, Flos Campi, a suite for solo viola, orchestra, and wordless chorus written by Rafe Van Williams. We heard it in the hands of Matthew Best with the Corydon Singers and the English Chamber Orchestra. We're going to move forward in time now to some living composers. In 2013, the vocalist, violinist, and composer Caroline Shaw won the Pulitzer Prize in Music for her Partita for Eight Voices, a work, she says, born of a love of surface and structure, of the human voice, of dancing and tired ligaments, of music, and our basic desire to draw a line from one point to another. Over the course of the four sections of this work, Shaw explores an astonishingly vast array of vocalisms: belting, classical singing, heady, fluty sounds, sighs, whispers, speech, throat singing, yodeling. When it was created, Partita, and also the group that recorded it, Roomful of Teeth, who were involved with the gestation and workshopping and the birth of this work, seemed to the choral world to renew and expand that sense of possibility with the human voice itself. Since that time, Shaw has gone on to bring aspects of that style to other composition, including something she wrote in 2016 called To the Hands, which was commissioned by the group The Crossing. We have heard on this program a series of cantatas by the 17th century composer Dietrich Buxtehude called Membra Jesu Nostri, and The Crossing commissioned a series of responses to those cantatas by living composers. And Shaw's To the Hands is a response to the third of those cantatas, Ad Manus, To the Hands. I've had the pleasure of conducting both Buxtehude's work and Shaw's work, and the first time I ever conducted Buxtehude's, it was with Shaw. She was one of the two violinists playing at that performance, and I remember just loving the way that she took Buxtehude's melodies to heart and then ornamented them. There are repeated ritornellos that fall between the solo verses, and Baroque violinists are free to add their own perspective to those sounds. It was a memorable and delightful performance, and I also was able to sing with Caroline, and we used to sing a lot of plain chant and Renaissance polyphony, so I was delighted years later to see that she was commissioned by The Crossing to create this work. We're going to play the first movement of Shaw's To the Hands, and it's a wordless prelude. Here's what Shaw has to say about the work itself. To the Hands begins inside the 17th century sound of Buxtehude. It expands and colors and breaks this language as the piece's core considerations of the suffering of those around the world seeking refuge and our role and responsibility in these global and local crises gradually come into focus. The prelude turns the tune of Ad Manus into a wordless plain chant melody, punctured later by the strings' introduction of an unsettling pattern. Let's hear this prelude as performed by The Crossing, directed by Donald Nally. We just heard the opening prelude of Caroline Shaw's To the Hands, sung by The Crossing, conducted by Donald Nally. And we'll end this afternoon with a few more recent compositions, also by living composers, that use just human voices and no instruments. The first is by Australian composer Sarah Hopkins. It's called Past Life Melodies. Here's what Hopkins says about the origins of the work. "Compositionally, I trust the power of the simple, direct, and heartfelt, and am guided by my intuition. Sometimes dreams and visions inform my music. Sometimes melodies seem literally to sing through me, as was the case with Past Life Melodies. I was in Sydney when the opening melody of Past Life Melodies first sang through me, and immediately it was a melody of profound connection, known and remembered, as though it were from a song from a past lifetime. It comes again and again to me at times of extreme emotion. It comes as a lament, as a means to express unspeakable emotions. It comes as a strength to transform sorrow, and lately it comes as a song of liberation. A second melody, Darwin, Australia, comes through. This one is very Aboriginal in feel. It sings through me all day as though there is an old Aboriginal woman chanting deep inside me. And finally, while walking in the hills and singing in Sausalito, California, the two past life melodies put themselves together. Later, as I sang and played them on the cello, a section of harmonic overtone singing immediately followed, like another past life song." So you'll hear these three different past life melodies, and in the third, you'll hear something that sounds like whistling. But this is, in fact, just another of the amazing capabilities of the human voice, overtone singing, where a singer manipulates the voice on a droning pitch in such a way that the overtones are completely audible and can actually be sung distinctly. This is Sarah Hopkins' Past Life Melodies, as sung by the University of Johannesburg Chamber Choir, conducted by Renette Boer. Yeah. As a conductor, it's thrilling to see new works being written and dreamed up that tap into all of the possibilities of the voice. As an artist, it's also a thrill to be introduced to new modes of expression and to have my ears opened to the powerful and amazing singing traditions outside of Western classical styles. Today's program is truly just the tip of the iceberg. The voice is the human instrument for communication, and its expressive possibilities are as diverse and as fascinating as we are as a species. Singing in new ways and hearing in new ways has as much to teach us about humanity as it does about music. We'll end this afternoon with a work by the living American composer Jake Runstad, Nyan Nyan. Runstad explains, Nyan Nyan is an exploration of the effects that one can produce with the human voice. I created original words to achieve varieties of colors and mixed and matched them within the ensemble to produce a diverse sonic landscape, incorporating effects similar to a flanger, wah-wah pedal, drum and bass, and synthesizers turns the choir into a full-fledged vocal orchestra. Let's hear Nyan Nyan by Runstad. Bruce Rogers leads the Mount San Antonio College Chamber Singers. Sounds Choral is produced at the studios of WWFM, the classical network. David Ozenberg, producer. I'm your host, Ryan Brando. You can listen to any recent Sounds Choral program by going to our website, wwfm.org, and clicking on Classical and Webcasts. You can also support programming like this with a donation in membership at our website. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Sounds Choral is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org. Yum, yum, yum.
Thank you.